This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Tara DeLandgraft on ABC Radio WA.
And hello. Yes, Tara DeLandgraft with you on this Monday lunchtime in the hot seat for Belinda Varaschetti for a couple of days, coming to you from the Esperance Studios in the state southeast, where it feels like winter has well and truly found us. I think the feels like temperature when I finished my hockey game on Saturday was -1, so a positively balmy day. Today, looking out the window, a feels like temperature of 10 degrees right now. And I do know there's been a bit of rain around over the weekend, still plenty of places that haven't had what they need. Let me know on the text line today, 0448 922 604. Are you still needing rain? Did you get rain? I would love to hear from you. And later in the program, we'll head to South Australia because some significant rainfall has fallen across the border, which is great news for producers there. And we'll also be heading to the top end because Australian live cattle exports are down about 30% compared to this time last year. And it's all because importers are struggling with the current high price of Aussie cattle. So we'll get to that before the news at 12:30. Before we do, though, the head of geopolitical risk at ANZ says scenario planning and developing playbooks is going to become increasingly important to farm businesses trying to navigate ongoing global volatility. Cameron Mitchell says the world is a lot less globalised today than it was prior to the conflict in the Middle East, and that makes decision making much more complicated. He says over the next 6 to 12 months, the key supply chain watch points will continue to be energy and hydrocarbon byproducts from the Middle East and the evolution of the relationship between the US and China.
It's been really interesting to watch for the last, say, 6 months or so. You've got a lot of deal-making sort of impulses from the US president, and you also have, I think, a pretty receptive audience from Xi Jinping in Beijing, where both leaders are really trying to put a positive spin on the dynamics in the relationship. And then underneath that, you've got decoupling is too strong a word, but definitely a concern in both capitals around relying on the other country for critical inputs into key elements of the supply chain. Technology is the most obvious, but it is expanding.
Looking at the role of China in the context of the Middle East, how much of a watch point is that as we see the continued situation in the Strait of Hormuz?
Look, China's got a really important role to play, I would argue, more indirectly. There is a diplomatic linkage in that China is obviously working with Pakistan. Pakistan's been a really important part of the, the negotiating teams that have been trying to work on a diplomatic solution between the Iranians and the US. But I think the really important role that China's playing is more in the energy and supply chain piece. And that is, you know, China's ability to reduce demand for oil, but also its ability to put oil on the market with its stockpiles, and then finally potentially present some solutions to some of the inputs from the Middle East that are tight in supply. So urea being a really good example. China's using coal processes now to produce more urea and has lifted export controls on urea, for example, I think about 2 weeks ago. So I think it's China's role in that downstream piece and its capacity to influence the energy market more broadly that's really important here.
Is there a risk, though, that our supply chains are swapping one dependency from the Middle East to another in China?
Look, I mean, it depends on how you look at it. There are short-term solutions that need to be made, and if that requires a pivot from one supplier to another for a short period of time, of course, that's potentially a neat solution. But yes, long term, if you're concerned around over-reliance on a single supply chain for things that you need for your company and you are substituting it with another, well, then, of course, you're potentially presenting similar problems down the track.
Thinking of the Middle East and the Strait of Hormuz, do you think there is a de-escalation in the short-term future of that particular conflict?
Yeah, look, it's possible. I think the challenge here is that the US and Iran need to come up with a solution that they can both stomach in terms of control over the Strait of Hormuz and what that actually means. There's talk about service fees being charged and so on. And I think one of the things we should be looking at is what's going on between Iran and Oman at the moment. They're having some diplomatic engagement. And I think any solution here probably does need to have Oman and Iran, given that they're the two countries that abut the Strait of Hormuz involved. So that's potentially a quick, not a quick win, but certainly the neatest way to solve the problem. The US would need to be party to and I guess endorsing of whatever agreement they came up with. Short of that, I think we're probably going to see this sort of oscillating period of diplomatic engagement between the two sides, followed by maybe some punitive military action and back again.
Is there a return to stability in geopolitics broadly on the horizon, or is volatility the new normal?
I think volatility is the new normal, if that's a quick and sort of neat way to describe it. Yeah, don't expect stability and sort of predictable. Well, policy might be more predictable, but it's not going to be an orchestrated policy across a number of countries. There's going to be different policy positions that will often be in conflict with each other, and businesses need to get more used to that. It's not a deglobalized world, but it's certainly a world that is less globalized than it was. And that obviously complicates decision making for business. And the outlook for the Strait of Hormuz and those kinds of flows, yeah, we were really lucky. We went into this crisis with a large glut, I think, of oil on the global market and food. And that gave us some buffers. And then, as you mentioned, the solution for a lot of countries to the problem was to tap into strategic reserves. China obviously was a really important player here with some demand destruction for some of that energy. But those solutions that we've been taking, I wouldn't argue are long-term solutions. They're temporary, which are helping alleviate some of those energy impacts. There's more oil on the market, ex Strait of Hormuz, than there was through pipelines in Saudi Arabia, for example, or additional capacity coming from places like Venezuela. But none of them are a neat like-for-like solution for the amount of oil that was flowing through the Strait before February.
So if you're operating in these supply chains, what are your watch points over the next 6 months? How do you navigate that in your own business? Are there strategies you can take to mitigate?
Yeah, look, there are. I don't know if they're strategies, but they're certainly approaches. And obviously for each company, it will be different. They're facing different tightness to the supply chain. There are going to be opportunities for companies when you have a tightness of the supply chain as well, of course, depending on which sector you're in. I'd say the sort of thing that maybe bigger businesses used to do or governments used to do, things like scenario planning, developing playbooks to work out what the impact will be to a supply chain. You sort of war game it, if you like, or scenario play it. They're really important because once you've done those kinds of activities, you can then assess the impact to your business. Depending on your risk appetite, you can modify your approach, or equally importantly, it's not as much, you've got the scenario planning and the wargaming aspects, but then you also need to determine what is it you're wargaming or scenario planning. Is it something that's going to be a temporary shock in the international system or one that is more strategic? And I do think that's not a shot in the dark exercise. There are actually ways of working out what the impacts are going to be over the shorter and longer term. Less reliance on the Strait of Hormuz over the next 10 years, I think, is almost certain, because Gulf states aren't going to want to rely on that waterway in the way that they did, given the geopolitical risks that are there. So there'll be alternate routes that are going to be developed. So that's one example, I think, of a long-term shift that we should probably start to bake in.
It sounds to me like the answer to volatility is know who you are and know what your strategy is.
Exactly. And don't be afraid to change your strategy in light of some of these developments. If you are exposed or there are opportunities that are pretty significant, then it's okay to adjust strategy or adjust risk appetite.
That's Head of Geopolitical Risk at ANZ, Cameron Mitchell, speaking with Callie Buchanan. 14 minutes past 12, and in good news, the Bushfire Watch and Act warning for Warman has just been downgraded to an advice warning, and that's a warning to monitor conditions as the fire is contained. So that alert level for the fire has been downgraded. The fire is now contained, but it's not controlled. There is no threat to lives or homes. You need to stay alert and monitor conditions. So just repeating that, bushfire at Warman in the Shire of Halls Creek has just been downgraded from a Watch and Act to an advice level and a warning to monitor conditions. So if you're in that neck of the woods and you'd like to keep an eye on that fire, you can go to the Emergency WA website. Well, Australian live cattle exports are down about 30% compared to this time last year. Indonesia remains the biggest customer by far, but even that market is facing some challenges. Cattle exporter Patrick Underwood has just returned from a trip to Jakarta, and he says Indonesian importers are struggling with the current high price of Aussie cattle.
A little bit of pressure commercially on, well, just importers concerned with a recent rise in Australian cattle prices. I think they expect a bigger bottom to the market. You know, we always tell them that the cheapest cattle from Australia will be in that sort of May, June, July period. So to have the market go back up in June, July was a bit of a shock from an already high place.
As in, it's been a long time that Indonesian importers have had to fork out more than $4 a kilo to secure cattle in the middle of the dry season.
Yeah, that's right. It just was a not as big as correction to hope, and then the market turned pretty quickly. You know, on the basis of just the cattle being drawn almost entirely from Darwin and therefore supply tightening up, and you know, just because that Eastern Australia job has been strong. It seems a little bit more unofficial, the cap on the Indonesian government cap on prices they can sell excess feedlots, around 59,000 repair. It was 55,000 at the end of the festivals up there at LeBaron. It's now sort of 59,000. You know, they're selling for a little bit more than that, I understand. But, you know, they've obviously got to keep that in mind, which if you bring that back to an Australian cattle price, it's sort of they're selling up there for sort of 530, 540 AUD. Well, steers have already gone past 440, you know, in Darwin, which, you know, really starts puts a pressure on the market. So, and it's been different 2 years ago. We were always the main suppliers of both meat and livestock, you know, from FMD-free countries like Australia, New Zealand, America, Canada, et cetera. So, you know, now there are some big quantities up there of Indian buffalo meat, Brazilian meat, now Argentinian meat. So I guess it's just something as a supplier and as a country, just have to be a little bit careful that our live cattle aren't priced out of the market.
Well, in big news over the weekend, JBS has struck a deal to sell 25% stake of its Australian and New Zealand operations to an Indonesian sovereign wealth fund. Not sure if you've seen that story yet and got any thoughts on it.
I've read the story. Well, it's interesting, and it's definitely something that we could hear, you know, more and more of is around the food security and these countries like Indonesia, you know, massive human populations and who are going to require a lot of food in the future. So it's interesting that they're taking measures in some significant commercial and financial transactions to potentially shore up food security in the future. I mean, that should be a very good thing for Australia in general. You know, we're so well placed from a geographical perspective for Indonesia. We're the logical supplier of live cattle, which they prize and treasure so much. So, you know, the fundamentals of the trade are there. We just see these, they seem to be more and more regular, but, you know, there are issues around prices into Indonesia. But, look, if you look at an Australian cattle producer, he's getting 430, 440 in the middle of the dry season for his cattle, high-grade feeder cattle. It's a pretty good rate. So I think, you know, since I've come back, even the week I've come back, we've seen some checks in the market, some things, you know, East Australian cattle prices just starting to come off the boil, but the Eastern State Shown cattle indicators dropped reasonably sharply. So fuel prices have spiked again, which is not great for us as exporters because we're paying that levy on a ship. So, look, it does appear these things tend to self-regulate, if you like, because it is a supply and demand situation. And if demand from Indonesia starts to taper off because of high prices, then it should follow that as demand drops. You know, the cattle price in Australia certainly blocks up, if not correct. So, you know, I think you're going to see the market sort of hold steady for another couple of months and, you know, possibly a bit of a surge towards the end of the year as we so often see, depending on seasons.
That's Patrick Underwood from the Australian Cattle Enterprises speaking to Matt Brown. And feeder steers to Indonesia via the Darwin port are fetching around $4.40 a kilo, with some higher prices forked out recently to help fill those ships. Well, staying in the north now, because over the weekend, unionised workers downed tools at BHP's Port Hedland operations. Now, this is the second time in recent weeks as negotiations continue between the mining giant and the unions. ABC reporter Kimberly Putlin has been in Port Hedland this morning and she told Mickey Cusack the full impact of the stoppage is still unknown.
There's a little bit of pressure commercially on, which...
Apologies for that. We'll just get the right audio for you.
I think the numbers are still coming down from the impact, and truthfully, I don't think we'll ever really get all the numbers down to the T. But what we did see is that there was an impact. So we heard from BHP who said ships continued to be loaded, and we did see ships being loaded and departing. I'm watching one right now leave the port. But what we heard from union sources was a little bit different. We heard that all bar two unionised staff walked off the job, all of those employed by BHP, that is, and that all loaders were operating at a reduced feed, which results in slower ship filling, meaning there's delays that cost BHP money. So unions have said there's been a significant impact, and BHP has sort of said it's business as usual.
Are you able to speak, or have you been able to speak to people, you know, workers when you're down there? And what's the vibe? What are they saying?
This strike is a little bit different. There wasn't a picket line. There wasn't a big union presence in town. We've had a few conversations just with people we've seen. Now, what we've heard just from statements from union officials from BHP, again, that there was significant impact. We heard that they expected about 150 people would take part. Then that's just on the Sunday alone. So yesterday, that's the strike that wrapped up at 5:30 this morning. And I think this time those numbers seem to be a bit more reconcilable with the numbers that we've heard from industry. What we've heard from industry is that day shift, 70 workers took part. So if night shift had similar numbers, that would be close to 150 workers, which is, we were hearing about 63 to 90 walked off the job earlier in July. So quite a big escalation on that first stoppage nearly a month ago.
Yeah, because it's been going on for quite some time now. Are negotiations progressing?
Well, that's right. This has been ongoing since October. That's when BHP and the combined ports unions started these negotiations. And they've had 11 bargaining meetings since then. Three of those have been with the supervision of the Fair Work Commission. The next bargaining meeting we are looking to will be the 18th of August, and that will be with the Fair Work Commission as well. BHP says it's looking forward to continuing negotiating with the assistance of the Fair Work Commission. And unions haven't ruled out strikes yet. They say that is in BHP's hands and that it'll depend on what comes out of the next meeting.
That was Mickey Cusack there speaking with Kimberly Putland from our offices in the north. And another strike is underway in Western Australia's north, this time at the Port of Broome. Stevedoring and maintenance workers have walked off the job for 2 weeks after failing to reach an agreement with the Kimberley Ports Authority over wages and conditions. Now, the Kimberley Ports Authority and port workers and the Maritime Union of Australia have been trying to negotiate a new enterprise agreement since October last year. The Kimberley Ports Authority says it will continue to meet with employees and the MUA and bargain in good faith to resolve the outstanding items, with the Fair Work Commission now assisting in reconciliation. The union has not responded to our requests for an interview, but this year it claimed in a social media post that its members in Broome are the lowest paid Port Authority workers in the state, living in arguably WA's most expensive town and region. And those parties are due to meet again on Wednesday. Almost time to head to the news. But before we do, over the past few weeks, we've been hearing of record high after record high for sheep selling at sale yards across the state and across the nation. But will the strong prices be enough to entice farmers who have left the industry or cut numbers to scale back up? And exactly how many sheep are left out there? That's what Rabobank animal proteins analyst Angus Gairdley-Burt has been pondering in recent weeks.
It's something I've been trying to work or been working on over the last couple of weeks and unfortunately don't have an answer for it at the moment. I mean, there are a range of numbers sort of between the 65 to 70 odd million head, but I suppose the interesting thing for me is the volume of sheep and lambs that we've actually slaughtered over the last, well, since 2024 really, and we all know down here it was dry through 2024. We saw large numbers of sheep being offloaded as well as the lambs at the same time, and it just doesn't feel like we've really recovered. And so I've got a sort of question looking forward, where do we potentially see any growth in that sheep flock, and therefore what does that mean for our overall lamb slaughter looking into the next couple of years, because it's contracting at the moment.
And what is the answer to that question of where there could be growth in the flock?
That is a $60 million question, in the sense that I think you can probably look at the cattle industry and say it's reasonably easy to, you know, whether you're a cropping operator or a mixed farmer or something, to add a few cattle to your operation. You can sort of accommodate it, or even if you're a small operator, buying cattle and operating cattle or running cattle is not too hard. But running sheep probably has a different layer of complexity that goes with it. There's obviously all the husbandry practices, there's shearing, there's crutching, all those sorts of things that need to be done. So it does appear that, you know, those people that have made the decision to go out of sheep, it's probably a much harder decision to go back into sheep once you've done that. So does that growth come from our existing production or existing producers, or are we going to actually see people make a decision to, yeah, put fences back in and revamp the shearing shed?
People probably need enticement to get back into sheep. If we look globally at the short, medium, long-term factors, is there enough there for people to look at that and think, okay, well, there is money in it for me?
I think so, definitely. I think that's one of the really strong attributes of particularly the lamb production side of things, or the sheep meat production side of things, is you look around the world at all the other commodities, grains, cattle, even dairy, you know, there are a lot of other big producers in the world. When you look at the world from a sheep meat perspective, it's effectively us in New Zealand that supply the lion's share of global exports for sheep meat. New Zealand's flock is pretty much static to declining as well, so they're not really growing. The opportunity to grow sheep meat as well from a consumer point of view, it doesn't have some of the limitations that beef does. So the opportunities to grow that consumption base, I think, is really strong too. So yeah, I have the feeling that you're probably going to see more of an organic growth rather than necessarily people going into the market and buying the flock back. And therefore, any sort of recovery will be a little bit slower than what it normally is. But, you know, sheep generally have a fairly quick turnaround rate. And given favourable seasons, you know, it can increase your lambing rates as we move through the season too.
That's Rabobank Animal Proteins Analyst Angus Gedley-Baird speaking there with Angus Verley. And almost time to head to the Weather Bureau to see what rain has been falling across WA. And then after that, we're actually going to head to South Australia, because there are parts of that state that have recorded record rain over the weekend, especially in the Flinders, far northern Flinders ranges, in some of that station country. Some really, really amazing rain has fallen in that part of the state. So really excited to head across the border after we speak to the news and the Weather Bureau, of course. Richard Hudson will be along to read some of the headlines in terms of what's fallen over the weekend, have a little bit of a look at what has happened over the weekend. But before we do head to the news, you might have seen over the weekend some pretty ferocious fires are burning in the Northern Hemisphere after a pretty extensive heat wave. Well, a task force of 46 West Australian firefighters and incident management specialists has been sent to the United States to help battle fires burning across that country. Now, the team comprises of 21 personnel from DFES and 25 from DBCA, and the total number of people being sent over from Australia and New Zealand is 187. So some of those representatives from WA are coming from Kununurra and Albany. They also include 15 DFES volunteers. Now, the crew left Perth for Sydney today, where the crews will be briefed before they fly to Idaho for a 35-day deployment. And given there are more than 80 big fires burning across the US with almost 30,000 personnel, they're working pretty tirelessly to get them under control. So we do wish them the best of luck and hope they stay safe. heading towards 12:30, so we're going to be a bit cheeky and head to the newsroom now. Jonathan Hopper is ready for us. Jonathan, what's making headlines this afternoon?
Good afternoon, Tara. The opposition leader says the coalition wants predatory inducements dealt with in Labor's proposed gambling advertising laws amid ongoing negotiations. The bill would partially ban gambling ads but does not deal with the issue of inducements such as free bets or special offers. Neither the Greens nor the coalition are prepared to back the bill in its current form, arguing the partial ad ban does not go far enough. Nine boys have been charged with 70 offences after allegedly stealing seven vehicles in WA's Kimberley. Derby police say the boys allegedly stole a tray top, a sedan, a quad bike and four motorcycles in the early hours of Friday morning. The charges include several counts of stealing and attempting to steal a motor vehicle, as well as trespassing. And the Australian Medical Association has welcomed a rise in bulk billing rates, but is warning the government's GP subsidy scheme may not be working for everyone. New government figures have shown that bulk billing rates have increased to more than 84% nationwide in the June quarter. Thank you, Tara.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. Jonathan Hopper will be back in about half an hour's time, because it is just gone 12:30. But as I mentioned, there's been quite a bit of rainfall that has fallen over the weekend, maybe not in some of the parts that needed it. We'll ask Caroline Crowe. Caroline, good afternoon. Let's start in the Southwest Land Division. What are things looking like?
Yeah, good afternoon, Tara. So we've got a cold front moving through the Southwest Land Division today. The cold front itself is actually just sort of passing through the Southwest Capes and Albany at the moment, but there's been lots of lines ahead of the cold front bringing rainfall through the Southwest Land Division. So the extent of the showers as we speak is sort of from around Geraldton all the way through to about Ravensthorpe, Hopetown area. So southwest of that line, we'll continue to move north and east during the day throughout the Southwest Land Division. This is the main feature for the week in regards to rainfall. So once this cold front has moved through, and I will say that there's also thunderstorms associated with the cold front. So the thunderstorm extent area is from around Dongara to Morawa, Meriden, Hyden to Balladonia, so good part of the Southwest Land Division we could see those thunderstorms in. Actually, there are quite a few happening at the moment as well, and possibly see some small hail through southern parts of the Southwest Land Division. So we've had reports of hail through the Perth metro area and could see it through parts of the Great Southern and South Coast as well. Today, as I mentioned, is the main day in regards to rainfall. I'll get into totals in a minute. But after this cold front moves through, coming into tomorrow morning, there'll be lingering showers just along the west coast, which will be quite early in the morning, and through the south coastal districts as well. The front will have pretty much passed through the Southwest Land Division as we get into tomorrow morning. Could see a little bit of hail, though, and a thunderstorm just about the coastal fringe, that Esperance coastal fringe, on Tuesday. Most of the Southwest Land Division otherwise will be clear from rainfall tomorrow, and then the ridge is going to dominate for the rest of the week. So Wednesday, Thursday and generally Friday are looking at mostly sunny conditions through the Southwest Land Division. Now, with that high-pressure ridge that's going to dominate the weather pattern, clear skies and cold nights. So through the remainder of the week, we're really looking at temperatures sort of below 2 degrees and near zero for a good part of the Southwest Land Division. So frosts overnight are possible for most of the Southwest Land Division inland from the west and south coasts, and that's through to the weekend as well. So that's pretty much what's been happening in the Southwest Land Division. Just back to today, though, for rainfall totals. The lower west and southwest regions and sort of about south of Durian Bay through Perth and the Metro Hills in that southwest corner, looking at 10 to 25 millimetres, and that's what we've seen, some locations around 20 millimetres so far already. But a good part of the Southwest Land Division otherwise should sort of see around 5 to 8 millimetres. So if we sort of go from around Geraldton through to Southern Cross all the way through to about Israelite Bay, 5 to 8 millimetres, a little bit the southwestern side of that and the western side might see a 10 millimetre fall. But sort of looking generally sort of around 5 millimetres throughout the southwest land division in regards to the cold front moving through today.
Well, we've got our fingers crossed, Caroline. I know that area of the Great Southern around sort of Wagen and through Nyabing, we're really, really hoping that they could have 10 mil or more. So if we can send some their way, that would be fantastic. Look, let's head to the north and the east now. What is that part of our state expecting?
Yeah, so through northern and eastern parts of the state. So, well, pretty much the north is clear and sunny along with the interior today. A little bit of cloud around the Eucalypt, but as this cold front continues to move north and east, we will see showers developing through western or southwestern and southern parts of the Gascoyne into the Goldfields and the western Eucalypt later today and this afternoon. So pretty much sort of could see a shower get up to Carnarvon along the west coast in the Gascoyne, but otherwise the line is generally from about Shark Bay through to Leonora and about through to Cajuna today. The southern side of that, where you get close to the southwest land division area, 2 to 3 millimetres, but otherwise less than 2 millimetres of rainfall for that region. As we come into Tuesday, though, so the cold front will have continued to move east. We'll be located over the Eucalypt. So we'll see the remnants of the cold front just bringing some light showers through to southeastern parts of the Gascoyne in the early morning, but otherwise showers through the Goldfields, the Eucalypt, and the southern parts of the south interior, and pretty cold as well. So we could see some isolated or some hail through the Eucalypt. And during the day, we'll just see all of that contract and weaken as the system continues to move east. So gradually clearing the gold fields and then gradually clearing pretty much most of that southeastern area during the afternoon and by evening. Coming into Wednesday, there will be just residual showers along the Eucalypt coast, and that's kind of for the remainder of the week as well. Up north, oh, actually, I finished down south first. As I mentioned, the ridge is going to dominate cold temperatures overnight. So we could possibly see frost through southern parts, not necessarily tomorrow morning because we'll have there'll be more cloud around and the rainfall. But coming into Wednesday, a large area of frost possible with those cold temperatures all the way through southern and eastern parts of the Gascoyne, the Goldfields, the Eucalypt, south interior, and possibly even getting up into far southeastern parts of the Pilbara as well, so that Newman and Karrajini area. That's going to be the most extensive and cold morning for those central and southern parts. Coming into Thursday, still cold for and frost possible through parts of the south interior, the Goldfields and southern Gascoyne. And then it sort of just gets confined to southern parts of the Goldfields on Friday. And in the north, some fresh and gusty easterly winds. There's that southeasterly surge pushing those winds up through northern parts of the state at the moment. So we are seeing, we'll see some elevated fire dangers as we get into Wednesday, possibly Thursday as well, with those gusty easterly winds.
Rightio. And any warnings we need to know about? I'm based here in Esperance and I'm pretty sure my phone popped up with a warning for sheep graziers.
Yeah, so there's a warning for the sheep graziers with the wet conditions and just the cold temperatures, because it's been pretty cold actually since we had that cold front move through over the weekend. But maximum temperatures today through parts of sort of 13 to 15 degrees through a good part of the southwest land division, a little bit warmer, 1 to 2 degrees warmer as you get further north. So there is that sheep graziers warning, as you mentioned, and also a marine wind warning. So we've got the strong winds associated with the cold front as it's moving through during today and tomorrow along a good part of the west and south coast. There's also quite elevated swells pushing through with these cold fronts as well for the next couple of days for those west and south coasts.
Caroline Crowe, duty forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology, thank you very much for your time on the Country Hour today. And Caroline mentioned there has been quite a little bit of rain around. Let me know, are you content with the rain you got over the weekend? If not, how much more do you need? I'd love to know. 0448 922 604 is our text line. You can text in. Richard Hudson is in our Perth studios. Richard, I feel like Caroline stole some of your thunder there, reading out some of those rainfall reports.
Oh, no, that's all right. At one stage, I thought she was talking about a shipload of rain. I was going to say, I thought that was trademarked by CBH, that particular expression. But anyway, in the 72 hours from Friday, 9 o'clock in the morning through to 9 o'clock today, no rain at all in the Kimberley or the Pilbara. In the Gascoyne, Ningen Station had 5 and Payne's Fine topped it with 7. In the interior, Warburton got a bit of a downpour with 13 mils. And in the Goldfields, Laverton topped it with 4. But a bit of rain around in the Eucla district. Eucla itself had 21, Forest 6 and Red Rocks Point 28. No rain recorded on the islands. And in the Southwest Land Division, yeah, looks like some locations got some rain. I think a lot would still like it a bit more. The cutoff figures gives you an indication of just how much rain fell in these subsections of the Southwest Land Division. So in the Central West, it's 10 and above. Arena had 17, Arrowdale 10, Badgingarra 19, Barberton East and Bindi had 16, Berkshire Valley 20, Canterbury 13, Eneabba 14, Eridu 10, Greengrove 21, Gutha West 11, Durian Bay 19, Lancelin Defence had 34, Mindala 10, Minganew 11, Mora 18, Nambung Station 21, New Norcia 19, North Island on the Abrolhos had 11, Wiradjuri East 14, and Wundi had 16. In the Lower West, there was a fair bit, so it's 30 and above. Anketell had 30. Bickley topped it for the state with 52. Bickley's just on the outskirts of Perth, due east. Dwelling Up had 48, Gidgeganup 34, Jandakot 30, Jarrodale 49, Carrigullen North and Mundaring had 44, Pinjarra 33, Rollystone 48, Tamala Park 40 and Whiteman Park 34. In the southwest, it's 20 and above, Acton Park 22, Bailing Up 21, Beetle Up 32, Boyne Up North 29, Bridgetown 22, Cape Naturalist 21, Carlotta 23, Chapman Hill 25, Collie and Darden Up had 20, Kawarram Up 24, Donnybrook and Ferguson Valley had 21, Harvey 37, Carriedale 22, Kirrup 25 mils over 5 days, Loguebrook had 47, Manjimup and Margaret River 20, Mount William 46, Mile Up 29, Nanup 25, Newlands 22, Northcliff and Rosabrook had 33, Pemberton 23, Shannon 24, Thompson Brook 21, Walpole Forestry 35, Willyabrup 25, Worsley Downs 26, and Yanmar had 29. In the southern coastal region, actually going to do 5 and above. I know people there have been pretty keen on getting some. Albany had 14, Amalup 9, Bremer Bay 13, Chain Beach 10, Chillinup 5, Dalyup Park 31, Denbarker 17, Denmark 29, Erinair 46, Esperance 21, Gardner 7, Nowanga up 5, Hopetoun 14, Ingleburn 6, Jacob and Jerramung up 5, Kimberley 29, Many Peaks 9, Mount Barker 16, Mount Howick 19, Munglin up 26, Oakmarsh Farm 23, Ongar up north had 6, Ravensthorpe and Stirlings north 7 mils, Salmon Gums Research Station 9, Stirling South had 15, Tamar 8, Tallina Downs 25, The Duke 24, Warrajarra 6 and Wellstead 7. And then in the Central Wheat Belt it's 10 and above, Ben Cubbin had 12, Beverley and Bonnie Rock 11, Burrakin 12, Cadoo 15, Cunderdon and Dalwallinu 11, Gabbin, Goodlands, Kellerberrin North and Cocodine all recorded 10. Long Forest had 12. Meckering North and Meriden had 10. Moorine Rock 11. Mount Noddy and Mount Westdale 12. Muckinbooden and Muresk 10. Narrambeen 14. Northam 12. Quadney 14. Shackleton had the same. Redlands and Southern Cross 12. Whale recorded 11. Wyalkie 10 and Wongan Hills 12. Then in the Great Southern, Boddington North 19, Boscobel 7, Brookton 9, Bullye 6, Chaming Up 11, Cherry Tree 6, Colorado 5, Coondee 12, Quartering 17, Corrigan 6, Cranham 8, Culford 27, Darkin 15, Dragon Rocks 5, Dumbleyung 6, Franklin 26, Glenrose 6, Highbury East 8, Hillcroft 10, Hyden 9, Katanning 5, Cochrane 5, Condinnan, Coolin and Quetta all recorded 6, Lake King and Magenta Dam 8, Maradong 18, Mordetta 6, Mount Madden East 9, Narrogin 12, Newdigate 5, Nyabing at one of the GRDC stations 12, Pingaring 6, Pingerley West 10, Pingrup 5, Poppaninning 11, Quail Up recorded 14, Wagen 10, Wandering East 22, Wickapin 6, Wilgarra 20, Williams 18 and Yealering East had 6. So as you can hear, some of those places which we've been reporting on over the last few weeks that are pretty desperate for rain, some of them got some, but maybe just not quite enough. But parts of South Australia and New South Wales have recorded some very, very lovely rain over the weekend. About 500 kilometres north of Adelaide in the far northern Flinders Ranges is a family-run sheep station called Mullaloo Station. Owner Rhys Warren says he's never seen rain like it in his time on the property.
It's hard to believe, but I tipped it out this morning and we've had 150 millimetres or 6 inches in the old scale.
That is incredible. Have you seen rain that much before?
No, not until this year. But, yeah, that's the third time this year that we've hit triple figures. So it's a very, very strange scenario.
And the creek's flowing there?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. We've got a house full at the moment. It's going to make sense. It's pretty easy. We've got plenty of time to fill the forms out.
What about stock? Are there concerns for them at the moment?
So we have been landmarking. So we gave that up a couple of days back when we saw the weather was coming in. And, yeah, the stock up here, they'll just go to high ground, stay away from the creeks. And then, yeah, to finish the job off, we'll bring a helicopter in now because it's going to be very difficult for us to access them on motorcycles.
Has there been any damage, shed fences, anything that you might have to fix up when the weather eases off?
Yeah, got a lot more grading and floodgate repairs to do. So we'll just have to monitor fly strike because we're a merino property, so that'll be a bit of an issue going forward. But there's going to be way more positives than negatives out of this. Like all our aquifers were pretty full anyway, and the springs that are dried up are running again. So just to have this top up, it's just going to be amazing for the bush, and it'll help some revegetation with trees and things just to get started. It'll be really good.
Have you already been seeing those impacts? As you said, it's been, you know, a quite wet year already. Has you already seen some transformation of the environment in the bush?
Oh, absolutely. Back to ground cover and a lot of saplings and things getting going. So, yeah, it's really good to see the ground getting covered up and protected.
Yeah, isn't it lovely to hear that that rain? Rhys Warren from Mullaloo Station speaking to Tom Mann, and while they were chatting, he was saying the rain was actually still coming in sideways. But just south of there in the central Flinders Ranges, Blinman recorded its wettest August day on Saturday with 68 mils. Tim Paschke farms about 170 kilometres northeast of Adelaide in South Australia's Riverland region, and he says the rain they had there in the last, just this month, has completely turned things around, which is great because, as you've heard on the Country Hour, on the WA Country Hour, their last few years have been really tough.
It's one of the best August rains. I was just talking to my dad, and best August rains that we can remember for such a long time. So compared to last year when we didn't even have our paddocks covered. So, yeah, real blessing. We ended up with 34 and a half at my place, but up to around, my dad had 44. So, yeah, it just is awesome. Like, it is an absolute game changer. We haven't lost any yield going into August. Sometimes, you know, obviously it can get quite warm and windy in August. But, you know, this year we just, obviously July was quite dry, but, you know, we had enough rain from June. So there's some real positives for us. And obviously my bank balance really needs a bit of a kick because it's been three pretty tough years up here.
It sounds like it has. Tim Paschke, he farms at Wakery, which is about 170 kilometres northeast of Adelaide in South Australia's Riverland region. And also, I believe it rained even further east from there in the far west of New South Wales, near around sort of Broken Hill Way. They recorded their wettest consecutive days since March. So they're just under 40 mils. And yeah, some of the stations in that area, Tara, I reckon the owners would certainly be smiling with the rain that's gone through anyway.
Yeah, thank you very much for that, Richard. Certainly seems like there's been a lot of rain around. I think you need to go and have a little bit of a lie down, a bit of a glass of water. I think there was a lot of rain to be read. And look, there was a lot that happened over the weekend. As we said, the rain has fallen. But also on Saturday at Roeburn, the region hosted its second Kalliura Rodeo. And our new Pilbara Rural reporter, Nikki Bailey, headed along. It was her first rodeo, so she was keen to get some tips on how to not stand out while being a newbie.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's make some noise.
It's a little journey to get here, but it's an absolute worth it. It's an absolute splendid day here out of Roeburn.
How can you tell when it's someone's first rodeo?
Oh, you know, you can tell when it's someone's first rodeo because they got the buck tours on the feet. And the Vans on the feet, and they got their skinny jorts, the jeans, you know, the jeans that the old boys wear, and they're around the knees. Yeah, you got them on. But then they got the flash button up like they're going out to Scarborough for a day on the piss. Right. The old day on the beers, yeah. That's how you know.
When they're walking around all drunk and they can't tell what they're doing.
I like to say Vans are usually a good indication, eh? Some reason all the newbies are always wearing Vans.
When it's someone's first rodeo on the Pilbara, they're either wearing what? Or they're wearing sneakers. That's how you can tell it's their first rodeo. Or the other prime example is they've got the Birkenstocks on and the Jordan shorts behind you. Probably the easiest way to tell.
That's Nikki Bailey chatting to some of the punters at the Roeburn Rodeo over the weekend. And Nikki was also keen to find out where the rodeo animals come from. So she tracked down Courtney Reinke, whose bulls were being ridden on Saturday. She started by asking what makes an animal suitable for rodeo.
Athleticism is probably the biggest thing. Brains, they really have to be able to handle surroundings. That comes with time and teaching them and just travelling them and campaigning them. So it's just to sort of like you take the time with them and hopefully they sort of come through and they can handle being out on the road with us, yeah.
And where do you get them from?
So these ones that I get, I actually breed, and I've also bought in from over east. So they come from, I've bought heifers out of Queensland, Mundubbera, Queensland. I've bought most of my cattle from Tamworth, New South Wales, a few from Scone in New South Wales, but yeah, mainly over there. But then all the other stuff that's kind of just getting a bit older now, I bought them off of another contractor over here. But yeah, I'm trying to breed just my own now. I don't have to buy any more in.
Yeah, because are they super expensive?
Yes, yeah. So buck and bull can range anywhere from, I think I paid 14. Yeah, the most I paid for one was 14 grand. That's hectic cheese. And then, geez, 3 grand from over east, yeah.
Do you get your money back in the events?
No. No, definitely not. You've got to love it. And you got to, for me, it's a bigger picture. It's what I can breed to showcase and then hopefully sell on later on. That's where the money's at, I reckon. It's just the genetics in them.
And do you choose who rides your bulls?
No. So it's all out of a draw system. It's all out of like a hat, so to speak. But it goes into a computer. We send our numbers off to the head office in Tamworth, and then they do all the draws and that. No one gets to stick their buddy mitts in anywhere. So yeah, it's all fair.
How often does an animal get injured?
Not very often. No, not very often. And most of the time, for the bulls, it's when you pen them up at home. They fight, like big bulls fight a lot. All the younger bulls are really good because they don't have any much testosterone going through them, so they don't fight a hell of a lot. So, but the big bulls definitely, they do get sore, but then they just don't go to the rodeo. Yeah, they go home and they go into the sick bend until they can heal, and yeah, they usually come good, most of them.
I think I need to go into the sick pen after hockey on the weekend. That was Bull contractor Courtney Reinke speaking with Nikki Bailey at the Carla Ura Rodeo on Saturday. It was held in Roeburn, which is about 35 kilometres east of Karratha in the Pilbara. And it's a little bit of a rodeo off on the Country Hour today because Australia's arguably premier rodeo took place in northwest Queensland yesterday, and the open bull ride was clinched at the very end. The last cowboy to climb into the chutes was an 18-year-old from Armidale in New South Wales, competing in his very first Mount Isa rodeo. And what a debut it turned out to be.
G'day, I'm Brady Meredith. I just won the open bull ride at Mount Isa.
So what's going through your mind?
Heaps. There's too much to really talk about, I suppose. Good to get something done up here.
Atmosphere here today, you were the last rider out. What was going through your mind before that ride?
Just make it count, I suppose. Just do something. I come in a pretty good spot and just thought I just need to ride a good one. And well, a couple of the boys made pretty good bull rides before me, so I thought I'll have to just really have a go.
Tell us a bit about yourself, how long you've been riding and all that.
About 10 years when I started. I was 8 years old. I'm 18 now, so 10 years. And
only 18?
Yeah.
Besides bull riding, what else do you do?
I'm like a boiler maker by trade. I'm doing my apprenticeship at the minute in Armidale. I'm about 2 years into that. Otherwise, just rodeo, I guess, yeah.
And how did you get into the rodeo riding?
No, really. Easy way to put it, I suppose. I just sort of was sitting at home and me and Dad were just fiddling around, I guess, with a few cows and that, and I thought I'll give it a go. And had a couple of family friends that pushed me on a little bit to get it all started, and then, yeah, Mum and Dad are just kept pushing me on, and my mates and that, they all just kept supporting me. So
was it always bulls all that time ago, or did you ride other stock?
Before I started riding bulls, and even when I first started riding bulls, I rode horses, like not barking horses, just rode horses around, you know, a bit of camp draft and whatnot. But I only ever rode bulls in the rodeo. So
as a junior, did you have much success?
Yeah, I'd say I went not too bad. I won't talk about myself too much, but
tell us a bit about it.
I won a couple of averages at the ABSRA National Finals and went pretty well. I had heap of success in every weekend.
How hard was that going from a junior rider to the senior riders like here in Mount Isa?
Yes, it was a bit, but I sort of, before I started stepping up onto them bit bigger bulls, I sort of tried getting on a few bit bigger ones in the practice pen just to get a bit used to it and whatnot, and did make it, I think it would have probably made it a little bit easier for me, but it is still, it's always going to be a big jump, I suppose, yeah.
And Mount Isa, this is your first time here. What's it been like, besides winning?
Yeah, it's been good. It's hot, very hot, but compared to Armidale, it's been cold there lately. But yeah, I come up here and a bit of fun with my mates, hanging around here for a couple of days, and good rodeo.
Yeah, where does it rank? You've done a lot of rodeos in junior and senior now. Where does it rank?
This is probably one of the bigger ones, I'll definitely say, one of the bigger turnouts I've been to. I'd say this probably outdoes a lot of them.
And the atmosphere, what's it like?
Yeah, it's good. It's very good. It's fairly decent crowd there today, and last night when I rode my first bull, it was a massive crowd. It's pretty cool, yeah.
Yeah, last night was a full house. Take us through that. What was it like?
I don't really know. I made another pretty good bull ride, and it was good. I jumped off, and everything was loud, and all my mates on the back of the chutes.
And what's ahead for you?
I'm not too sure yet.
Would you like to go to the States?
Yeah, I've got plans too. I'd like to try and finish my apprenticeship first, and then I'd like to go over when I finish that and see what sort of luck I can have over there. But I'd definitely like to go over eventually, yeah.
It's tough going being a bull rider, isn't it?
Yeah, it's tough. And trying to work a job too.
The money's not huge, is it?
Shows like this, I suppose it's better than a week's worth of work. But if you're not riding them every weekend, it's a hard way to make money, yeah.
You're only 18. How are you going to celebrate?
I'm driving home tonight, so it won't be a lot of celebrating tonight, I don't think, but I'm sure when I get home I might have a few beers or something.
And Mount Isa Rodeo, will you be back next year to defend your title?
I'll give it a go, yeah.
What's it like to win here?
Bigger than anything I've ever really won. I've never had so many cameras put in my face before, but it's a big deal and very special. Everyone talks about it all year round. It's very, very good to win it.
That's 18-year-old Brody Meredith speaking to Andrew Saunders after winning the open ride in yesterday's Mount Isa Rodeo. And we'll head back west now to Cattle Pen for a bit of a different reason now, because almost 2,000 head of cattle were sold at the Mouchet sale yards this morning. So numbers up on last week by about 650. Terry Birkin's been keeping an eye on the prices for us.
There was a store sale incorporated in today's trade sale, with big lines of both local and pastoral weaner steers and heifers, with many lines yarded over double pens. Like-bodied pastoral cows were also presented to the buyer gallery, which was attended by the regular processors as well as a large presence of restockers and feedlot buyers. Local Wiener steers remained firm, while Wiener heifers were slightly cheaper. Pastoral steers overall gained 20 cents, as did young pastoral heifers. The cow market eased 15 to 20 cents, while bulls remained firm. Local Wiener steers were selling from 380 cents to 602 cents, while Wiener heifers started from 330 cents to 490 cents a kilo. Local yearling steers returned 430 cents to 542 cents, while yearling heifers were selling from 340 to 464 cents a kilo. Pastoral steer cows were yarded in a wide range of conditions, selling from 150 cents to 470 cents, while pastoral yearling steers made 190 to 450 cents a kilo. Pastoral heifer calves returned 186 to 448 cents, while yearlings ranged from 150 to 430 cents a kilo. Grown steers sold from 300 cents to 482 cents, while grown heifers returned 380 to 400 cents a kilo. Light frame plain pastoral store cows started from 20 cents to 140 cents, while bigger frame stores made 150 to 252 cents. Medium weight cows returned 256 cents to 304 cents, and heavy cows sold to a top of 332 cents a kilo. Young bulls ranged from 180 to 458 cents, while heavy pastoral bulls ranged from 150 cents to 298 cents, and local bulls remained firm to sell to a top of 330 cents a kilo. This is Terry Birkin for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks, Terry. It's news time now, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.